The presentations are going to go one after the other, and we're going to end with Q&A for the rest of our allowed time. Thank you, Michael. So please hold your questions to the end. You should have got a program when you came in the door for all of the academic programming. Most of our academic programming is here in the comics track because the comics track is awesome. But we also have panels in the anime, manga track, Stargate track, and a few others. So please check that out in that program. So without further ado, I'm going to announce our presenters. We have Austin Hendricks from Georgia Regents University. And Kari Storla from the University of Southern California. Austin's going to go first, and his presentation is Waiting for Heroes, an Examination of Psychological Disorders, Existentialism, and General Strains Theory in Superhero Films. Please welcome Austin.
Hey, everybody. So like he said, my name is Austin Hendricks, and I'm going to be talking to you guys today about psychological disorders, existentialism, and general strain theory in superhero films. And before we can get started with the fun part, I have to make sure you guys are familiar with a couple of terms that we're going to be using throughout the presentation. So those are personality disorders, schizoid personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, the specific tenets of existentialism that I'm going to be focusing on, general strain theory, and operant conditioning. So, without further ado, personality disorders are fixed patterns of behavior that deviate from cultural norms and expectations, and they have to lead to a certain amount of distress or impairment in the individual for them to be considered a disorder and not just a certain kind of personality quirk or characteristic. Typically, these are thought to be relatively stable and not fluctuate a lot during the lifespan, but some of the recent research coming out has shown that this is not always true. Some of it shows that the symptoms increase, and some of the research shows that the symptoms decrease as individuals age. We can fix the... make you guys deaf. The two specific personality disorders that we're going to be focusing on are schizoid personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. So schizoid personality disorder features a lack of interest in developing social relationships. They don't typically have many close friends other than first degree relatives, and those are kind of the relationships that you have to have at a young age in order to develop and survive. They typically choose solitary activities. They don't take pleasure in many activities, including sex, things like that. They don't respond well to praise or criticism. And there's typically a what we call a blunted affect. And this just means that there's not a whole lot of emotional expression. They're typically very kind of, you know, and that was a terrible impression, I'm sorry. okay. So you typically have that kind of overt, blunted, kind of not a lot of emotional expression, but that overlies a sensitive persona that some of the research suggests kind of wants to develop relationships, but the individual typically doesn't actively seek those out. But that's up to debate. So there's know that this is not a very cut and dry field. The next disorder is narcissistic personality disorder, and these individuals typically have a very grandiose self-image of themselves. They have fantasies of unlimited power, success, and brilliance. They require excessive admiration from those around them. They kind of display that typical haughty or arrogant behaviors that you're going to see very clearly pretty soon. They lack empathy, and they have a sense of entitlement. And there's a couple of different theories to explain how this disorder develops. Typically, it focuses on the idea that parents are either overindulging to their children or neglectful of their children. And so those are the typical theories, but the ones that we're going to focus on are Mahler's rapprochement subphase and Masterson's narcissistic fixation, which I'm going to explain thoroughly, so don't worry. So Mahler's rapprochement subphase focuses on the idea that at around 15 to 22 months of age, children typically have this, in normal development, they have a very grandiose sense of self, and they're kind of full of themselves, if you want to say that. It's a little mean to say to kids, but, you know. but they also typically have trouble differentiating themselves from their mother, specifically, because this is a psychodynamic theory in Freud, and the mother is important and awesome. A little too important. But what happens is that the identity from themselves and their mother tends to begin to kind of differentiate at this point, and this results in some separation anxiety, and what ends up happening is they attempt to gain more attention from the mother, from their mother. And what happens is she doesn't return that attention to the degree that they want, and so this lessens their grandiose sense of self. And that was Mahler's rapprochement subphase. So for Masterson's narcissistic fixation, it focuses on the idea that prior to this point, the child has to have something happen to result in that narcissistic personality disorder. And so he focuses on two different ideas. One in which the mother does not reject that attention from the child, and they're kind of overindulgent to them, and this results in them not losing that grandiose sense of self, and so it kind of proliferates into this disorder. But he also has an alternative explanation in which the child shifts that relationship from the mother to the father, and if the father displays narcissistic characteristics, it doesn't necessarily have to be to the point of the disorder, but just those characteristics, the child identifies with that, and it results in the actual disorder. Existentialism, for those who don't know, is a philosophy, and the two specific philosophers that we're going to be focusing on are Beckett and Kierkegaard. So Beckett's idea focuses on the idea that reality is subjective and not an objective truth. And so when people confront that fact, they are left feeling disoriented and confused. And for Kierkegaard, we have two different theories that we're going to be focusing on. There's two different awarenesses of death, the first of which focuses on the idea that individuals are aware of death from a very early age and it's kind of recurring throughout their lifespan, whereas the other is not aware of death until it's actually occurring or about to occur. Additionally, he has these three different stages of life: the aesthetic, ethical, and religious. And the aesthetic phase focuses on the idea that, I think focuses a lot, satisfaction with one's physical desires. The ethical phase focuses on realizing one's duties in life and attempting to obtain those, or to realize that duty. And the religious phase focuses on the idea that the individual cannot accomplish those duties alone, but must rely on some type of higher power. General strain theory, on the other hand, focuses on the concept of strain. And this is some type of negative experience that results in these kind of tumultuous feelings. And typically it is the loss of a positive stimulus, the presentation of a negative stimulus, or the failure to achieve a positively valued goal. Operant conditioning focuses on a couple different things. You have a positive and negative aspect, which is just whether you're adding something or taking something away, and we refer to that something as a stimulus. And then reinforcement or punishment. And reinforcement increases behavior, and punishment decreases the behavior. So you typically see a lot of, like, we're going to do some positive some negative reinforcement, like for whipping kids to get them to behave, and that's not what it actually is. So now you all will know what that is. So positive reinforcement is like giving a child candy to get them to do something you want them to do. Negative reinforcement is taking something away to get them to do something you want them to do. So like taking away a kid's phone to get them to study more. Positive punishment is that more, I'm going to whip a child, or the corporal punishment to whip a child to get them to do something you want them to do. And then negative punishment is like taking away a teenager's door or something like that to get them to stop texting or whatever. Now we get to the fun part. we have clips. If I can get them to play, maybe they'll play.
Okay, this is Mission Boss, but no more. I've sung you out, I've set your bones, but I won't bury you. I've buried enough members of the Wayne family.
You'll leave me.
You see, only one end to your journey. Leaving is all I have to make you understand. You're not Batman anymore. You have to find another way. You used to talk about finishing about a light beyond that awful cave.
After Rachel died, knowing that we had decided to be together, that was my life beyond the cave. I can't just move on. She didn't. She couldn't.
What has she had?
I can't change that.
What if before she died, she wrote a letter saying she chose Harvey Dent over you? And what if, to spare you pain, I burnt that letter?
How dare you use Rachel to try to stop me?
I am using the truth, Master Wayne. Maybe it's time we all stop trying to outsmart the truth and let it have its day. I'm sorry.
You're sorry? You expect to destroy my world? And then think that we're going to shake hands?
No. I know what this means.
What does it mean?
It means your hatred. And it also means losing someone that I have cared for since I first heard his cries echo through this house. But it might also mean saving your life. And that is more important.
Goodbye, Alfred.
All right, so as we've seen in that clip, Bruce is, this is a very emotional scene for Alfred. He's losing basically his, what amounts to his son. And Wayne's just not giving him that emotional, that similar emotional response that Michael Caine is so eloquently demonstrating. And he's very flat in his emotions, especially given the severity of the situation and what's happening. Additionally, he's not responding to Alfred's criticism. He's just kind of ignoring it. Alfred's like, well, you're going to kill yourself doing this. And he's just like, okay. Whatever. And it shows how solitary this activity is, because he's not really trying to maintain his relationships with Alfred or develop more intense relationships, more lasting relationships with other people. Now, the next clip. Yay. Clips are out.
Interrupted peace in years because of me. chair, sipping on an iced tea, because I haven't come across anyone who's mad enough to go toe-to-toe with me and my best gang.
So, of all the many, 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 many clips of the Iron Man, from the Iron Man films and Avengers and so forth, this scene kind of encapsulates his narcissistic behaviors. The whole Stark Expo is a testament to his need for admiration. It's named after him. As well as a lot of the arrogant behaviors. He has his own intro, which I'm a little disappointed we didn't get that intro. But there's a lot of, he holds his hands up in this like operatic manner to convey power and things like that, and is there's so many clips. Alright. So now that we've kind of caught you guys up on the theories and whatnot, we're gonna talk about how their disorders develop and bring it all together. So for Wayne, the death of his parents at that early age results in a loss of his initial reality in which his parents are gonna always be there for him, they're gonna support him, things like that. And this results in strain because he's losing not only his reality but this positive presence of his parents. And what this does is it institutes a new reality and causes him to develop the schizoid personality disorder to distance himself from further occurrences of that strain so that he doesn't have to develop those relationships and potentially lose those individuals again. It also causes him to transition from Kierkegaard's aesthetic to the ethical phase at a very young age and also become very aware of death at that age. So he kind of realizes his duty to Gotham and the people in his city as a whole. And causes him to become very aware of the reality of death and the danger, or obviously the potential results of his activities. And finally, he also feels fear when his parents dies, obviously, because, you know, someone's shooting your parents in front of you. And so in order to deal with that fear and the anxiety that it produces throughout his lifespan, he projects that fear onto the people he saves, and by saving them, he kind of, in effect, saves himself. And by reducing the anxiety that he feels, he conditions himself and he reinforces his own vigilante behaviors. Now, Stark, on the other hand, he kind of has his disorder prior to the events of the film, and so it's most likely that at a very young age, he kind of does what Masterson talked about and shifts his symbiotic relationship from his mother to his father. Because as we've seen in like Captain America, Agent Carter, Howard Stark displays a lot of the similar characteristics as Tony. And so it's likely that he identified with those and it reinforced his own narcissism. He also initially isn't very aware of death and its possibilities, and that's very influenced by his disorder and his feelings of power. And then when he gets blown up by the Ten Rings in the first film, it becomes very apparent. And so he kind of shifts to not only becoming aware of death and trying to fight it, but also becoming aware of the duties that he has to fix the rights of his company. And that's why he develops the Iron Man suit, as well as dealing with the strain that he feels following his when he's attacked. At that point, he loses that reality that's been put into place by his disorder in which he is all-powerful, and this causes strain. And so in order to cope with that, he develops the Iron Man suit as a potential shield from further occurrences of the strain, as well as to give him back the power that he believes he's lost. And so now we have to ask ourselves, why does this matter? I can get up here, I mean, it's cool to talk about this stuff, but what does it kind of translate to the real world? And the answer is in labeling theory. And this states that basically what society considers deviant depends on a number of different factors. Who is committing the act, who is seeing the act, and the time period at which it's occurring. So these characters, I mean, they're superheroes, so they're, you know, these larger-than-life characters, and so even though they're doing something that we technically could consider deviant, we don't view them as deviant and as these potentially disastrous people. Additionally, we kind of identify with the pain that they've gone through, especially for Wayne. We kind of recognize that could potentially happen, and while we probably don't have the money to, you know, become Batman, which would be cool, we kind of identify with the loss that he's shared, or that he has had, and we share those feelings. And for Stark, he's just so charismatic that it's, and Robert Downey Jr. plays him so well that we identify with him and kind of forgive him for his being an asshole. And finally, the time period at which he's occurring, this is a very, as we talked about in the previous panel on comic books and cinema history, or in current cinema, this is a big time for comic books and films, and the superhero film in general, and that it's becoming more acceptable for these films to come out compared to, you know, in the past, which, yes, I mean, they had TV shows and stuff, but it's not quite as big as it is today. It definitely wasn't as big as it is today. And so these characters hopefully are showing how we're experiencing a shift in the treatment of people with psychological disorders away from a point where they're stigmatized into where they can be more accepted and adored by the public. And while it's not there yet, as evidenced by these two statistics I have up here, 43% in this study that I looked at, 43% of people in the United States believe that individuals with psychological disorders brought them on themselves, with 35% believing that this is the direct result of sinful behavior. And so while we... So hopefully these films are showing how we're shifting to a different understanding of these disorders and becoming more accepted. Thank you.
Thank you, Austin. Now we're going to go directly to the next presentation and hold questions for the end. So we've got Kari Storla. Her presentation is Superheroes, Super Trauma. Is trauma in superhero comics a human or superhuman experience? Please welcome Kari.
Hi, everybody. I want to start out by saying that I am not a psychologist. So I'm actually looking at things like trauma and psychology from the viewpoint of a rhetorician. So I'm looking at them from the way we talk about that and what it means for the way we live our lives and things like that. So just so you know where I'm coming at this from. This is a work in progress. I've been thinking about things like trauma in superhero comics for a really long time. I've laughed at the cliche of superheroes with dead parents as much as anyone and gotten absolutely furious over the trope of rape as backstory for women more than most, but it's not something that I've looked at deeper, and that's something that I wanted to do. So there's a long connection between psychiatry, psychology, and comics. And it's apparently something you have to mention every time you talk about psychology in comics, because every source I read talked about it, so I am doing my due diligence in mentioning it here. So it goes all the way back to things even like Freud. By sheer coincidence, the year that Freud died was the year that Superman got his first titular comic. You also have things, of course, like William Moulton Marston and as the creator of Wonder Woman, and of course our best friend Wortham, who with Seduction of the Innocent was one of the causes of the institution of the Comics Code. You also have things such as Batman. Without psychological disorders, Batman wouldn't be Batman. Gotham wouldn't be Gotham without the rogues gallery that is basically a giant metaphor for every psychological disorder discussed in the 20th century. So there's been tons of previous research, from everything from Spider-Man to how graphic novels are a good representation for the fragmentation of trauma, to how superhero narratives are used in play therapy. But I want to talk more about how trauma is depicted and what that means. In particular, I want to talk about origin stories of superheroes and what kinds of trauma lead to the production of superheroes, and how some are legitimated while others are not. In order to do this, I'm going to talk about the comic Incorruptible and Irredeemable. These were two comics that kind of went together, if you're familiar with them. I'm going to be focusing on Incorruptible for the sake of time. And I'm going to talk about how using Incorruptible to argue that superhero comics work with dominant cultural ideologies. So the way that our own system of beliefs for how the world works work to legitimate some traumas while marginalizing others through their depiction of which traumas serve as appropriate superhero origin stories. In doing so, they work to support the status quo related to how we think about gender, race, sexuality, and so on. But first, I want to talk about and establish a basis for what trauma is, particularly in relation to superhero comics. Going back to my best friend Freud, who is by no means my best friend, Freud was one of the founders of trauma theory, so he talked about trauma as essentially a shock to the system. It's something, an experience that the body isn't prepared for, or the mind isn't prepared for. So it overwhelms you, and you're not able to integrate it into yourself. This leads to a fragmentation. So you're not able to make it a part of your life story, a part of your narrative. You can't access it. Beyond Freud's discussion of trauma, which I'll come back to a little bit later, and without going over the entirety of trauma theory, one of the most important ways that trauma is discussed comes from the DSM. So when trauma was first defined by the American Psychological Association in the DSM-3 in the 1980s as a part of post-traumatic stress disorder, they said it was something that was beyond the range of human experience. So it's easy to see why superheroes are connected to trauma, because superheroes are also beyond the range of human experience. Sharon Packer says that trauma is often the MacGuffin that drives the story and defines the motivation for superheroes. This point becomes obvious when you think about how superheroes are spurred by tragedy. So for example, here's an image of just a few superheroes who have traumatic origin stories. That's actually a lie, I just googled DC versus Marvel. But I think it's fairly accurate either way, except for the fact that there's some villains in there. But villains also have traumatic origin stories, so again, I think it works. Of course, superheroes and supervillains aren't the only ones that are traumatized. I'm pretty sure if you live in Gotham for long enough, you have approximately 100% chance of being traumatized. The problem is, what is considered a legitimate trauma? So what's considered a real trauma, and what's considered, that's just the way things are, and you need to deal with it and get over it. There's a lot of people in the world of comic books who are traumatized. Think of all the events that go on in comic books, how many times the world has almost ended. Think of how many superheroes there are. Now, admittedly, not everybody's going to gain superpowers, but there are a substantial number of superheroes who don't have superpowers, who use martial arts abilities, who use money, and who use technology. So even that isn't necessarily a barrier to becoming a superhero. Laura Brown, however, talks about something that is not directly talking about barriers to becoming a superhero, but how we talk about trauma. As defining trauma as beyond the range of human experience, the problem is that human experience isn't defined as everybody's experience. It's defined as effectively the Western, white, cis, straight male's experience. So other people's traumas aren't really considered traumas. Instead, it's only the traumas that, quote, disrupt those particular lives. So those of the dominant groups and those in power. This can be seen through the case of Annie, who goes by the name of Headcase, which is rather appropriate for the topic of trauma. And so I'm going to talk about that in the case of Incorruptible and Irredeemable. So just to give a brief summary of the comic for those of you who may not be familiar, Irredeemable set out to answer the question of what would happen if Superman went rogue. And not just like ate some bad kryptonite rogue, like legitimately, completely, utterly off the scale rogue. So there's a superhero named Plutonian who's effectively Superman. And one day he just snaps and destroys Sky City. Thousands die. And he starts hunting down his superhero team, the Paradigm, one by one. In response to this, you get the companion comic Incorruptible, where Max Damage, which is one of the coolest names ever in comics, realizes that, well, previously he was a villain and one of the Plutonians' foes. All of a sudden, there's not going to be anybody around to save people from the really bad stuff that's happening. So he says, without him, we have nobody. So I decided we needed somebody. So Max Damage decides that he's going to become a superhero. He does this with his sidekick, Jailbait, who unfortunately her name is not ironic. And so they go about trying to become superheroes by doing exactly the opposite of what they would do as supervillains, which has about as good of consequences as you would expect. But to talk about where Annie comes in, part of what Max Damage does when he becomes a superhero is he decides that he needs to end his relationship with Jailbait, because her name, again, is entirely descriptive. At one point, Jailbait runs off because she's upset about this, and Max Damage realizes that if his enemies realize Jailbait is out there alone and relatively unprotected, she will be attacked. So he manages to find Annie, who looks a little bit like Jailbait. Annie has been attacked by the White Diamond Gang, so they've attacked her and threatened to sexually assault her. The White Diamond Gang is a white supremacist gang, and Annie is a lesbian Asian American. I believe at one point it says she's of Japanese descent, but I'm not 100% sure on that. So Max Damage, in return for rescuing Annie, asks her to put on Jailbait's costume and go around pretending to be Jailbait for the night so that people won't realize that Jailbait's missing. Annie reluctantly agrees, and they go about showing up at bars, doing various crime-fighting things, until Max Damage takes Annie home. At this point, Annie walks into her home to realize that the White Diamond Gang has killed her entire family. So those are the traumas that Annie undergoes that help her with her superhero origin story. This is something that Incorruptible explicitly calls out. If you can't read it, it says, those racist sons of bitches killed my family and no one would help me. And I just put on this friggin' costume because apparently I just had a superhero origin story. I don't know, okay? So it's something that the connection between trauma and superhero origins is something that Incorruptible and Irredeemable as well is very aware of. However, Annie's trauma is dismissed and seen as pathological rather than as a legitimate reason for her to become a superhero. Early on in the comic, Max Damage says that she's just using this as an unhealthy coping mechanism. She's putting on a mask because it's not, she can't be herself right now, so she's going to go pretend to be somebody else. So while Max Damage can become a superhero in response to his traumas, Annie can't. Laura Brown, who's a feminist psychologist and trauma therapist, talks about how women's traumas and other marginalized groups' traumas are often pathologized. So this is a matter of you just need to deal with it. And it's also a matter of people being made responsible for their own responses to trauma. So for example, both Laura Brown and Judith Herman talk about the ways in which women who are in abusive relationships are often blamed for that relationship. So it's a matter of they don't leave because they really want to be abused. In the 1980s, for example, a group of psychiatrists who were all men wanted to introduce a mass... That's important because of the gendered nature of this, not because I'm blaming men. wanted to introduce a masochistic personality disorder to the DSM that would effectively be for people who were in abusive relationships to pathologize this. Luckily, that did not make it in. And in doing so, this ignores broader structural issues. For example, the fact that women in abusive relationships, and anyone in an abusive relationship, may not have access to economic resources. They may need to protect their children or want to stay with their children where they wouldn't be able to otherwise. This also operates in superhero comics. So Annie's trauma is denied as a legitimate trauma because it's not that big of a deal, but it ignores the gendered, raced, class, and superpowered components. Annie's scene is not having a strategy for dealing with trauma, moving from active to passive. Instead, it's seen as unhealthy. So for example, she creates a grave and buries Annie and says, I'm only headcase now, which admittedly may not be the healthiest thing. Again, I'm not actually a psychologist. But there is a matter of she's trying to take back control from this trauma that she underwent. That's not seen as legitimate for her, whereas for other heroes, both within the Irredeemable and Incorruptible comics, and in comics more broadly, mainstream superhero comics, it would be. Instead, she's flawed. She's a literal head case. Max Damage is the one who names her that because of her what he sees as her issues. All of this comes to a head when Max Damage rejects her in front of the Paradigm, so in front of other superheroes. So not only is the nature of her trauma rejected, but the fact that she didn't gain superpowers because of it is seen as a reason why her trauma is too pedestrian. It's not good enough to be a real trauma. It's well within the range of every day. Brown again says that, quote, real trauma is often only that form of trauma in which the dominant group can participate as a victim rather than as a perpetrator or ideology. So in order to recognize Annie's trauma as a trauma, it would have to be recognized as gendered, as raced, and as something that was affected by superpowers. For example, Freud, my best friend, originally was talking about how his patients were abused sexually as children, and this was something he later retracted to say, no, you were just having sexual fantasies about men in your lives, such as your fathers. Because in order to have the first hypothesis, it requires a challenging of social structures, particularly patriarchal social structures in this case. So for Annie, recognizing her traumas as traumas requires not only recognizing the race and gendered components, but also recognizing, for example, the superpower components. So the fact that the White Diamond Gang was created as a response to the Plutonians' actions. Not that they likely weren't racist and stuff beforehand, but that particular circumstances were part of a larger structural effect. So not acknowledging that means that you don't have to fix anything. You don't have to deal with those hierarchies where superpowered people are placed above non-superpowered people, and where men are positioned above women, and where white people are positioned above people of color. Sandifer says that superhero traumas are consistently kept separate from any politics of identity. The Hulk, for example, his origins as being nuclear testing, as a result of that, are often kind of forgotten or ignored. So the political ramifications of his trauma have kind of fallen by the wayside over the years. So only some traumas are seen as appropriate, and most of the time those aren't political ones. Even for those people who are non-superpowered humans, so if you take out that element, for example, Jensen, in his study of Batman, says that since even the greatest tragedy doesn't transform most children into superheroes, the key element in Batman's origin is not the murder of a mother and father, but the extraordinary focus of a young boy. And that is likely more than accurate, but the problem is it ignores broader social issues. Annie, too, is incredibly focused. She quickly learns how to crime fight, how to engage in combat, However, she's still not seen as a legitimate option for being a hero. Women in comics are more likely than men to be victims, including in often, quote, particularly brutal and at times sadistic forms. However, men are more likely to be the superheroes. Is this just a matter of men in superhero comics being much more focused? Or is it, as I argue, that cultural ideologies help constitute what we consider to be real traumas and how they play out and how they are reinforced by comic books and who is written as a traumatized superhero? It works to reinforce the status quo, in other words. Of course, as Phillips and Strobel point out, Cape Crusaders are not critical theorists. So we can't necessarily expect superheroes to take broader social issues into account when they're determining who gets into the "my parents died and all I got was this lousy spandex" club. But as writers and readers of comic books, we can. In other words, right now, trauma in superhero comics, particularly mainstream ones, works hand in hand with the idea of trauma as being beyond the range of human experience, where human experience has a very narrow definition that works to marginalize and reject the other traumas of other groups as legitimate. Incorruptible helps us see ways in which this doesn't necessarily have to be the case, how other traumas as well could be legitimate, through the ways in which Incorruptible explicitly calls out Annie's origin as a superhero origin. It helps us see the way that might work. Through being critical of the way we view comics and of how trauma works in comics, this may help us get a better understanding of human as applying to more than just those with or in power. Thank you.
Okay, now we will take questions for our panelists. Yes?
I have one question, one comment. Gary, I want to thank you for the intersectionality and everything that you have included in your grad school. I was a sexual trauma so and then for Austin, have you utilized any of this in clinical practice? And if so, how did your clients respond?
I feel like I should have prefaced this before. I'm actually an undergrad. So, not at all.
Okay. I work with severely emphasis on the mentally ill folks, and I don't think that they would have seen Iron Man yet. They've been in the hospital too long. Okay, well, do you think that folks in the future, do you think that they would respond well to
trauma?
Possibly relating.
Or not to trauma. Trauma theory. Okay.
Possibly saying, I'm noticing some of these symptoms, Batman or Iron Man.
Oh, using superhero films as a
educational tool.
Okay, I got it.
Potentially about their personality.
Well, it's worth noting that schizoid personality disorder, it's really rare.
Sure.
It occurs, I think the DSM says, in less than 1% of the population.
Yeah.
And so there was actually debate in shifting from the DSM-4 to the 5 about removing it completely. And so I don't know how often clinicians see individuals with schizoid personality disorder. I think it'd be interesting if they tried to use the Batman films to do that, but I think that it would depend on the individual. So
if I could jump in on that really quick, I know that superhero traumas are used as like narrative therapy, particularly with children. And also there is a history, particularly with like soldiers who are being treated for trauma and PTSD, of therapists relating those experiences to the war movies they have seen and how actually that's a problem.
Yeah.
Because of therapists identifying with the experience shown in the movies rather than the experiences that their clients actually have.
Yes.
My question for Austin. Okay. In looking at the research, a lot of times the thought is once your personality disorder. So in the presentation, it talks about how their experience leads to the personality disorder. In the research, did they speculate at all about what their potential was for, what the potential already was there for the mental illness, how that how that influenced their personality disorder?
Or you mean like genetic component?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see if that makes sense.
Is there any speculation in the research about that?
For narcissism, yes, there's another theory that focuses on temperament, which is genetically influenced, and how an individual responds to positive or negative stimuli, like the way they perceive it. So if you perceive it as positive, you respond well to that. If you perceive it as negative, you respond accordingly. And how that, coupled with parents who are either neglectful or overindulgent, can kind of lead to this proliferation of narcissistic personality disorder. And so basically, if you have an individual who's highly sensitive to a negative stimulus, and then you have the neglectful parents, it kind of pairs a little bit to lead to this. Again, it's very difficult to prove a theory in psychology, based on what I've seen. And then for schizoid personality disorder, there actually is research suggesting a correlation between childhood neglect and childhood physical abuse and schizoid personality disorder. However, it's important to know that correlation doesn't mean it causes it. It means it's related. It's the big message of a psychology class.
So back corner first.
Hi. So you presented Batman and Iron Man were notoriously wealthy, and there is a proliferance of wealthy white males with traumatic backdrops as heroes. Would you argue that while you mentioned the predominance of mental abnormality is more accepted, would you argue that they could afford to be mentally abnormal, to have these personality disorders or these mental abnormalities?
In the realm of their universe, yes, definitely. They're viewed as eccentric, not, you know, deviant. So I would argue that, yes, their wealth kind of lends them a little bit of forgiveness, for lack of a better word, I guess, or acceptance, maybe, on the part of their peers in that universe. Because then that goes back to labeling theory, and that what's labeled deviant depends on who's seeing it and who's doing it. So the rich are less likely to be labeled as deviant or, you know, terrible people, even if they should.
I had one.
Yes.
Thanks. I had one for Kari and one for Austin. Thank you for two tremendous presentations. With regard to women's treatment in the comic universe, I think a lot of the progress that's been made more recently is just due to the fact that many of these stories began anywhere between 30 and 60 years ago, you know, when the country was in a different place. Not to say that the concerns of women and people of color and, you know, immigrants was any less important back then. It was as important, if not more. But I think it was a much more heteronormative white male society back then. The artists were white males. They were largely targeting young white males with the materials. So that's why I think we see so much, we see such an emphasis in those kind of things in comic books. And they've been very slow to come around, but they are coming around. I think that gives us a little bit of hope that things are going to get better.
I think that just in general, in comics and for whatever, it is a movement forward. It's just a slow and incremental movement forward. So it's something that continues moving forward. Like, if you look at the speeches from First Wave Feminist, which I realize I'm going a little bit outside comics, but there is a graphic novel on Sally Heathcote about feminism, First Wave Feminist. But you replace some of the words and update the vocabulary a little bit, and you could write in this blog post today. So it is a movement forward, and there's a lot of progress that's been made, and we need to celebrate it. But it's also something that the situation is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
is not affluent and who's you know, has diagnoses on many axes, right? Yeah.
I must admit, I'm not as familiar with the dead, with the Deadpool character as I am with the others. So there, in order to meet the criteria for the disorder, as it's outlaid in the DSM, the criteria that I talked about for the two disorders, you have to meet a minimum of four for the kind of categorical outlay of personality disorders. But for, they shifted a little bit, and some people are using this, some people are not, to a more of a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And so I'd have to look at all the personality disorders again, and that's a lot of criteria. But I feel like the one that might apply a little bit more to Deadpool would be antisocial personality disorder. Again, I'm not trying to issue, like, I'm not, this is not a definite, you know.
Yeah. You're not throwing down.
Antisocial personality disorder with narcissistic features.
That would be
the official diagnosis.
That would work with, yeah.
I always usually go with just that shit.
Okay, who else has a question? Yes, here, and then in the front.
I want to have a question for Austin, turn back to Kierkegaard. You talked about Batman specifically in the ethical stage. Would you ever see him as moving on to the religious stage at any point?
If he... It depends on if you kind of accept that Superman is Christ figure kind of thing. I'm not as familiar with the religious, the absolute, the like full religious part, phase of Kierkegaard, because I mainly focused on the aesthetic and the ethical. I do know you have two types. I cannot remember for the life of me what those two specifically say. But I would say that if he does, it's more than likely that Superman would be that higher power. Simply just because he is that powerful, and it would kind of lend to the, I can't do this by myself, I need someone else to help me. Which I guess would most likely come into play if he was dealing with like Doomsday or someone like that he can't feed on his own and needs something bigger. But it's, yeah, this is kind of like trying to force philosophy to fit a specific example, which is a little, you know, dangerous.
There's a really great book on superheroes and the religious by Ben Saunders. I believe the name is Do the Gods Wear Capes? I'm going to check it out. Okay, here in the front.
Hi. I feel like I have to apologize because this is a super specific question.
Don't apologize. It's fine.
Never apologize.
But I've been developing a superhero because I want to be a comic book writer someday. And her origin story is heavily traumatic. She gets kicked out of home, and eventually people try to manipulate her to bring the end times. Standard route, I guess. But what I really want to do is, like, kind of really, like, research a lot so I can, like, do it justice. Like, she's probably going to have PTSD no matter what. And also, like, I'm thinking that, like, a lot of it is going to have to do with, like, her learning how to accept relationships with other people into her life again after her parents reject her. So, like, where would I start with research? And can I email you people with questions?
Yes, you're welcome to email me. You can leave my card if you want it. And that's a really complicated question. It's a really good question. There's a lot of debate in trauma theory over whether or not it's possible to even represent trauma, or whether it can only be talked about basically as a metaphor. So if you haven't been traumatized, are you even capable of understanding that experience? Because you can read the words and understand the words, but you'll basically interpret the symbols differently. You don't have the same meanings for them. But the idea of doing that research is really important, and I can point you to some things, so talk to me after.
I feel it's actually been a source for her.
Okay.
NAMI.org, NAMI.org, National Alliance on Mental Illness. They have a huge library of instruction sheets, and that would be a good place to start. They'd also give you reference guides, things like that, that you can find more information.
That was NAMI.org?
NAMI.org.
She's got cards.
Yeah, I work for the National Alliance of Mental Illness.
Okay. Here.
You spoke about having these films increase the visibility in society and the importance of that and how behaviors are accepted. But sort of, I think, importantly, the labels are never there. And so while these behaviors might have increased visibility, there's still the, I guess, ingrained reaction to the words, you know, personality disorder. And so I wanted to tie that actually to the upcoming Deadpool movie where they explicitly stated that they're not going to change his behaviors, but they have, you know, specifically stated that he is not mentally ill, that he is not, you know, schizophrenic, which is a huge part of his character. And I wanted to know if either of you had thoughts about that sort of increased visibility of symptoms, but still not being willing to put the labels there.
That's a good question. So that kind of ties back into labeling theory, in that, I'm really getting back to labeling theory. So yes, these disorders are becoming more apparent in films. Now, whether people recognize that or not is a different story. I would hope with narcissism they would, simply because they kind of state it in the end of the Iron Man 2. They tell it, they say, you're a narcissistic. So I would hope that, or I would say that yes, the disorders are becoming more prevalent. And the labeling theory part would basically say why they're not labeled as deviant, with a negative stigma attached to that. Because of who they are, because of what they do, and because of who we are as people and how we identify with them, we're less likely to label them as deviant and attach that stigma to them. Such is not the case all the time with individuals with actual psychological disorders. There's heavy, heavy stigma attached to that term, not just personality disorders, but psychological disorders in general. So it's my hope that as people begin to associate, or not to associate, to become more aware of these disorders, and which will hopefully occur in places where they're more likely to see them. So like in superhero films, it would be my hope that they would see these people and it would help them become more aware of these disorders. And less likely to catch that label.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm gonna try and make it as uncomplicated of a question as possible. So this is for either of you to answer, but Austin specifically, you had said, it was just an offhanded comment, but you were saying, you know, we were learning to accept because of seeing these in the media and stuff, but you had also mentioned the word adored. And it's unquestionable that it's really important for us to have representations of those of us that suffer from different mental disorders. But what do you think about that specifically, that you've seen some people perhaps emulate things that these people that they want to be like superheroes are going through? And I know there's a lot of issue, not to discredit anyone's autonomy, but that there's a lot of issue with self-diagnosis and people kind of attaching themselves to these traits that a superhero has or that someone they admire has. And I was just wondering what you thought about that specifically.
Do you want to take this? I thought I haven't
talked a bit. I can start, but I'm mostly going to be talking off the top of my head here, so just keep that in mind. I think that there's a lot of complicated issues with that. Part of it is that, in going back to the previous question, terms like narcissist and like psychotic and different things like that get thrown around without a really concrete reference to the like their DSM definitions. So you have that problem as well, but when it's in terms of things like self-diagnoses and like emulating characters, part of it is a matter of there's a balance there, right? You don't want people to say, no, you can't identify with this trait, but you also don't want to be like, have people appropriate a disorder they don't have. So I think that for me personally, and this is a personal answer, it's a balance of saying I identify with this trait, but not necessarily this disorder.
Thank you.
Can I ask it?
that psychopath is another word that gets thrown around an awful lot, and that's not actually a disorder. That is a term. It has multiple multiple stigmas attached to that, and it's not just behavior, it's biological, or theoretically, there's debate, but it's supposedly biological differences in the brain. So be careful who you call a psychopath.
So this is for Carrie. My question is, for the simple women that are superheroes in their background stories, are they seen as traumatic and are relatable to men, or are they more women traumatic issues? Like, I never really thought of the different backstories in traumatic and how they affect it.
That's a really important question, but I think it kind of depends, and to some extent it's both. Particularly in cases where it's the rapist backstory trope. There's been a lot of work, less in comic scholarly work that I've seen, but I've seen a lot of really good blog posts on it, about how that is more designed to identify with men. So this idea that men are going to protect them. Or, for example, a lot of times the woman's the superhero, but her significant other or her father or something is also a superhero, and the main focus of the story ends up being on him. So it's her origin, but in a way it's somebody else's origin or somebody else's story more than it is hers. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. But.
Well, I thought it was interesting how you brought up that a lot of comics going out in the media is really helping people understand these psychic disorders, these disorders, and getting us more acclimated and more accepting of them, because they're fabulous white guys with tons of money, so it's okay if they're crazy. Meanwhile, on the other hand, that's not okay for minorities or women within the comic stories yet, and that we are trying to get better at that. But we can accept these crazies if they're fabulous and wealthy and white men, but we can't yet accept them from anybody else, and how, you know, it's hard and slowly moving forward in that, but it still really shows. And that's what is my question? how can we move forward with these things? How can we get better? Besides just putting it out on the media. So I was curious what you guys think you could do to get better. That's my question.
You want to start, or I can?
So, there is a theory, defense is a complex subject. You have labeling theory, but you also have other theories. And Kinney's theory, which the name of the theory escapes me, is like social dominance or social conflict theory. Basically states that what is labeled as deviant is a function of the dominant class in society. And so seeing how predominantly in American culture you have the white men who are wealthy as the kind of stereotypical dominant class, they tend to write laws, they tend to pass things, influence society in a way that expands their power, maintains their power, and prevents threats to their power. And so I would say that if you do want to make it more acceptable for non-white affluent men to have these disorders, you would have to, changing the dominant class and making it very, very, very apparent to everyone in that society that it's okay for women, for minorities to have these disorders in as superheroes and still be accepted, still be loved, and that kind of thing. You would have to change that. And not have to, but it would help.
I think there's a couple things. Part of it is letting marginalized groups own their own stories. So even if it's a white person writing a story about a black character, or a man writing a story about a woman, or a straight person, you get the point. Not telling it implicitly from the view of the dominant group. So doing research, taking into account various things about cultures, about circumstances, about context. I think also the need to challenge and interrogate social structures. So not just leaving those in place and leaving them assumed and letting them be naturalized, but saying, hey, this is the way things work. Does it have to work that way? Why does it work that way? You can do that in comics. The thing is, how do you do that? And I think part of that is it's not just a matter of doing it in comics. It's a broader social change. Comics is a part of that. So you have to look at it in the big picture and, like, you know, zoomed in as well. But I think that one way to do that is, I just totally lost my train of thought, which was, I was getting to the big important point. If I think of it again, I'll let you know.
But I like that, get the stories out there. And that's really one of the big steps to do.
Oh, part of it is reclaiming vocabulary. So vocabulary words that are used, like reframing them to give them different meanings that, are the vocabulary of the marginalized group and have meaning from them, but because you're using the same words, you're putting them in this context, so it's called like perspective by incongruity. You're making them seem perspective by incongruity. It's where you take something and you put it in a totally different context, and it like denaturalizes things.
I think if we could squeeze in one more quick question here on the side.
Let's say that you have two proto-superheroes, one male and one female, they have the exact same trauma. How will that influence each of their outcomes? Will, if the female character gets gang raped versus the male character being gang raped, how does that, how would you see the stories panning out?
That's a really complicated question. In real life, reactions to traumas are very,
yes,
very, very. So like Judith Herman talks about how we can't talk about PTSD, we have to talk about complex PTSD, because it's not just this is what happens, it's a big spectrum,
yeah,
of what happens. And at the same time, you can't also just divide it to male and female, because that's a context, and you also have like the gendering, so you have that socialization as well, but it's not going to be a because this, because that. At the same time, there have been like certain trends that have happened in comics. So, for example, Batman was raped. That story tends to get forgotten or kind of made fun of and made light of. It's not considered a real thing.
Because it's a male dominated society.
Whereas a lot of times for women characters, it becomes the entirety of who they are,
yeah,
or a big part of it. So there's trends.
Yeah.
But.
Okay, Michael, will you raise your hand? Raise your hand. You. Mike has some program pamphlets. If you didn't get one on your way in, please grab one on the way out. We'll be back in this room tonight and for the rest of the 4 days, but we'll be here at 7 and 8:30. But please join me in thanking our speakers. Yeah.